Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
We're here today to protest the 8th year of war and occupation in Iraq.
Coming up, we'll join peace protests in downtown Chicago on the 8th anniversary of the war in Iraq.
There hasn't been a different dominant narrative that has come out to say, here's a different story.
We'll also hear from commentator David Sirota on the role popular culture from the 1980s affected policy and protest today.
So we're talking about six and a half million people would have to be evacuated.
And what would happen if a nuclear meltdown were to occur in the Chicago area? We'll find out from Dr. Andrew Cantor. But first, here are some headlines from the Indie Media Network in Chicago and around the world with Mitchell Chabinchik.
Argentina Indie Media chronicled the furious efforts of grassroots activists to build dozens of community radio transmitters in a week's time. The second integral factory of radio communications was a week-long initiative in the Argentina city of Cordova during the week of February 6th through the 13th, 2011, which saw 200 people assemble 59 radio transmitters for 76 community organizations across Latin America. The whole initiative followed up a similar effort in 2010 in Buenos Aires, called the First Factory, which saw some 60 radio transmitters built and distributed to help expand community voices and local media across Latin America. Indie Media Global at indiemedia.org featured the story of right-wing vigilantes taking control of a Romani neighborhood in a village in Hungary. On March 1, 2011, uniformed members of the vigilante group Civil Guard, an offshoot of the neo-fascist paramilitary group Magyar Garda, took control of a Romani neighborhood in the village of Gyungyuspata, setting up checkpoints at the entrance to the neighborhood and forming a human chain around Romani houses. The Civil Guard is supported by the right-wing Jobbik political party and is condemned by international human rights groups who have urged Hungarian authorities to intervene. The European Roma Rights Center reports that there were at least 48 attacks against Romani in Hungary between 2008 and 2010, resulting in 9 deaths. DC Indie Media featured a dramatic protest blockade where thousands of labor union members and activists besieged a Washington, D.C. fundraiser for the Wisconsin Republican Party. The headquarters of the lobbying firm BGR played host to the fundraiser on March 16, 2011, whose protest was so large it clogged the streets outside the building. Some activists who wore suits in a so-called suit block managed to elude security and enter the building to display protest signs inside the event. Activists outdoors proceeded to march to the White House, then to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, despite the objections of D.C. police, before returning to BGR to resume the blockade. Miami Indie Media featured developments of the Fort Lauderdale, Florida chapter of the international anti-hunger group Food Not Bombs, which has been harassed by Fort Lauderdale police. Quoting from the feature, the group claims that police recently raided a house illegally and that officers are making a concerted effort to stop them from feeding homeless people. The group also claims that police shut down the electricity of the house of a number of Food Not Bombs activists, even though the electric bill for the house was paid. During the aforementioned police raid, a female activist was inappropriately frisked, and officers inquired about the political leanings of house residents. Members of Food Not Bombs held a solidarity march to decry the police intimidation and violations of civil liberties. Portland Indie Media featured a victory where workers at two Portland, Oregon nonprofits won the right to keep veto power over workers being fired. Streetlight Porch Light Shelters and Harry's Mother, two Portland-based nonprofits dedicated to assisting at-risk youth, wanted to force employees to submit to binding arbitration rather than keep a peer review panel which held power to overrule any firing decisions that the nonprofits may make. Workers at the nonprofits, under contract with the Portland chapter of the Industrial Workers of the World Labor Union, held protests for 4 weeks objecting to the proposal, and on March 20, 2011, negotiators with the nonprofit's parent company agreed to the workers' terms. New York City Indie Media featured the announcement of a reopened Mexican murder investigation whose victims include a slain Chicago-born Indie Media activist. In 2006, Brad Will, a 36-year-old member of the New York City Indie Media chapter who was originally from the Chicago area, was shot and killed covering a community uprising against the government of the Mexican state of Oaxaca. On March 10, 2011, Mexican prosecutors reopened investigations into the deaths of 21 individuals killed in the uprising, including that of Brad Will. A representative of the group Friends of Brad Will released a statement which read in part, quote, "True justice in this case will identify and bring two people known to have committed these acts of violence, and an end to the U.S. taxpayer-funded Merida Initiative and the so-called drug war," unquote. Chicago Indie Media posted a number of features in the month of March, including a summary of Chicago-related actions in solidarity with worker protest actions in Wisconsin against the draconian proposals of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Chicago Indie Media also broke news of the release of Eric Kane, a prisoner held in jail since 1986, who was tortured by Chicago police under the infamous John Burge regime to confess to a double murder that he did not commit. Chicago also featured coverage of the March 19, 2011 protests commemorating the 8th anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq, including news of a dramatic court victory affirming the rights of Chicago protesters at the original March 19, 2003 Iraq anti-war protest in downtown Chicago. We'll hear more about the recent March 19 protests in downtown Chicago and the related legal victory later in the program.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to Chicago Indie Media's website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches. On March 19, 2011, about 1,000 people rallied at what's now called Liberation Square at the intersection of Michigan Avenue and Congress Parkway in downtown Chicago. The rally focused against U.S. wars abroad, including the ongoing occupation of Afghanistan and the continuing U.S. involvement in Iraq despite an ostensible end to the war in Iraq. We'll hear now from Jolene Kirschman, an organizer with the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism, who helped organize the rally.
I'm Jolene Kirschman. I'm with the Chicago Coalition Against War and Racism. And we're here today to protest the 8th year of war and occupation in Iraq in particular. We are also calling attention to the struggles for freedom and democracy across North Africa and the Middle East. We are also recognizing that there are uprisings of the working class across the Midwest, from Madison to Lansing, Michigan, to Columbus, Ohio, to Memphis, Tennessee, to Indianapolis, to Boise, Idaho. So we are recognizing that and urging people to become a part of that struggle.
Regarding the wars abroad, this has been 8 years of American war that the United States has been engaged in. But we've ended combat operations in Iraq. So how do you respond when people say, oh, that war is over? Why are you still protesting?
Well, we still have 50,000 troops there. And the ambassador to Iraq said last week or so that there's just no way they're going to be back in 2011. In addition to the troops that we have there, we have at least as many or more mercenaries. We have contractors. The country is full of U.S. contractors. Just a week and a half ago, there was a day of rage in Iraq. The people of Iraq rose up against the U.S.-imposed regime. The regime retaliated by arresting over 300 protesters, vandalizing two independent media offices, disappeared three reporters, destroyed equipment in both of these media offices. So the free and democratic regime that we supposedly have imposed through 8 years of war and occupation is not being met by the Iraqi people as such.
What are the connections between the protests here today and protests that are going on since the beginning of the new year, both in the Middle East, Northern Africa, and in the United States?
Well, I think they're all a demand for independence, freedom, democracy abroad. It's standing up to U.S. foreign policy, saying, don't intervene on the side of dictators. Don't intervene on the side of repressive governments. We've seen that we're able to do that. There's no word when the Saudis come in and help put down the protesters in Bahrain. And the domestic side, my theory is that we have just witnessed the most massive transfer of wealth in our history. So the same empire that thrives on war also needs our wealth. Well, they've already got it. The middle class has virtually vanished, and the working class is now under assault. So once they've got our wealth, they cannot put up with a militant working class. So the next step is to attack trade unions. In particular, they're hitting the public sector trade unions and slashing what little safety net that we do have left. In the sort of midst of slashing of the safety net, they're privatizing what else we have, and then it becomes part of something that can be made profitable. So I see the connection is very close. They're just sort of two sides of the same coin of empire.
Turning more to Chicago and this particular protest, in the past we've seen pretty brutal treatment of protesters and protests by local authorities, by the mayor's office, by local media and other powers that be. What's been the treatment for this protest that's regarding all these authorities, and what do you expect with the forthcoming Emmanuel administration as to what we may see in the future regarding protests like this?
Right. Well, the anti-war movement in Chicago has waged a long and valiant struggle to be able to be in the streets and to exercise our civil liberties. I believe it was in 2006, we finally gained access to Michigan Avenue, which we had fought long and hard for. And so we're exercising that right today and marching up Michigan Avenue. I suspect we're going to meet with little resistance. There'll be some cops marching alongside of us, and I expect not much else. I should mention that 2 days ago, the appeals court just reversed a decision saying that 900 protesters who were, and some were not even protesters, they were shoppers who happened to be in the street, that were swept up in 2003 at the beginning of the Iraq War, they have to be dealt with and their class action must go forward. So that is good news. Rahm Emanuel, I have no idea. I'm a little scared. We've sort of learned Mayor Daley and how to work with him and through him and around him. Emanuel has this shared sacrifices motto that he's throwing about. I expect that means an assault on city workers, public workers, teachers in particular, perhaps. In terms of civil liberties, we'll just have to wait and see.
Was there anything else you wanted to mention?
I do want to also mention that in sort of simultaneously with the attack on public workers and organized workers, we have also seen an attack on civil liberties. We've had FBI raids on people's homes here in Chicago and in Minneapolis, as well as some other places around the country. And so we see this as a move to intimidate the anti-war movement in general and solidarity workers in particular. So we are here to protest that and ask an end to that as well.
That was Chicago peace activist Jolene Kirschman. The rally also marked the 8th anniversary since the Chicago anti-war protest on March 20, 2003, when some 17,000 protesters marched on Lakeshore Drive against the launch of the war in Iraq. That protest was forcibly stopped by Chicago police and Illinois state troopers, who unlawfully arrested close to 900 protesters and passerbys. But attorneys on behalf of the protesters fought in court on March 17, 2011, won a key victory, which we'll hear about from a presentation held during the rally itself. This is Melinda Power from the Chicago chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Hi, everybody. 8 years ago today, tens of us, thousands of us marched arrested about 900 of us as we were lawfully, legally protesting the war in Iraq. The National Lawyers Guild represented every single person who was falsely arrested, and every single case was dismissed. We then filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of everybody, 900 people roughly, and we were about to go to trial since the city refused to settle when the case was dismissed by the trial judge. On the 17th, 2 days ago, the appellate court ruled the arrests were totally wrong, they were totally illegal. We have a right to march in the city of Chicago with or without a permit. And the judge said the police should not have arrested people without giving them, one, a warning to leave, and two, an opportunity to leave. The police did not do that. I hope the police read the decision. I hope they learn that what they did was legally wrong. And this is a case that has been going on for 8 years. The attorneys representing you have been determined to keep fighting until we win, because we will not let the police say the people cannot protest in the city of Chicago. We now say the city of Chicago needs to settle this case. They need to compensate the people who were arrested, some of whom were held up to 40 hours in jail and had to go to court 3 to 4 times before the case was thrown out. We say that the city of Chicago needs to recognize and admit that what they did was wrong and they will not do it again. And when we're talking about economics, you should know that the city of Chicago has paid attorneys to represent the police $7 million to represent them for the illegal arrest that they did. We are keeping on with this case until we win, and if you are one of the people who was arrested or detained on March 20th, and we haven't contacted you, look for me, look for any guild attorneys with green hats, and we need to put this case behind us. The city needs to recognize its error, and we reaffirm we have a right to protest and a right to march. Thank you.
That was attorney Melinda Power. More audio and video from the March 20th, 2011 protest is available online at the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
In 1972, a crack commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team.
The popular movies and TV shows of the 1980s might seem to be light years away from the struggles facing political activists in a second decade of the 21st century. And yet, as a new book by David Sirota contends, popular culture of a time decades past is relevant to current policy and political activism by creating the environment which would affect future policy in thinking about grassroots collective political action. David Sirota, newspaper columnist and radio host, is the author of a number of books, including his newest book, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now. David Sirota was in Chicago on Thursday, March 24, 2011, for a presentation at the Chicago offices of In These Times, and was interviewed by Aaron Sinek for the website Chicagoist.com.
One of the last questioners already answered one question I had, which is kind of the whole cyclical nature of, you know, every 30 years, etc. But did the fact that you're 35 now, so did the fact that, you know, the 80s was your generation kind of play?
Oh yeah, I mean,
you decided to write about the 80s rather than 70s or 60s.
Yes, I mean, this book was, the appealing idea of writing this book to me was that it was part culture, part politics, part sort of standard history, but then also part personal experience. And so I guess I was especially interested in this topic because I felt a personal connection to it, but I really, really tried, and who knows if I succeeded, but I hope I did. I was very cognizant of trying not to let my own generational experience make me or delude me into thinking that my experience was in the 80s, because it was important to me, meant it was important to everybody. So a shorter way of putting that is that I tried to look dispassionately at whether the 1980s really was as culturally enduring for the American psyche as it was for my psyche. And that's why I think, that's why you'll see that a lot of this book has a lot of indisputable data in it. That, and I specifically included it in there so that people would know that this is not just me saying, look, I like the A-Team, you know, right? Like, I did like the A-Team, and you know, but so did 7 million other pre-teens.
Right.
And so
I'm one of them.
So yeah. So there you go. So I think that not to give you too long an answer, but I just think it's easy to say all this stuff is, oh, you were just a kid and it seemed bigger to you than it did to society, but that's the whole point, right? If you're a kid, that's why a lot of the stuff is focused on what kids were learning, because kids are the 80s kids are world-shaping adults now, and kids don't have the filter like adults do to discern as much between knowing or distinguishing between entertainment and real life. So when the A-Team tells you the government, you can't trust the government, and you're five, that's one of the stories you're going to be looking at the world through when you grow up.
Now, does that, how much of that, you know, the kind of the remakes that you show of 80s pop culture now, how much of, is there a correlation between those kids being the professionals today and entertainment producers just kind of running out of ideas?
One, I think that the entertainment producers of today, many of them are children of the 80s. So they're literally drawing on the stories that they were told.
Right.
And you could say, well, what about the entertainment or entertainers of the 1980s? They were kids in the 60s. Yeah, except for the fact that really, as I show, things really, the storylines are really changing in the 1980s. It really was a point of transition, of fluidity. I would also say that you're right, that as much as the children of the 80s are making the drawing on their own lives to create the stories for today, I also think that those storylines endure just beyond the media producers' personal experiences. They have now become ubiquitous in our culture. I mean, I showed you those presidential races,
yeah,
those 50s versus 60s. You know, militarism, you have to defer to the commanders. There hasn't been a different dominant narrative that has come out to say, here's a different story, right? Let's give you a hypothetical. How about we really, our first reaction to an international crisis is not to go to war. How about if the commanders say they want to escalate, we're not going to escalate. We're going to ask questions, you know? How about, hey, asking African Americans to be quote-unquote post-racial or transcend their race is really bigoted, because you're asking them to get, quote unquote, beyond who they are. Those are not the dominant narratives, right?
Right. Now, on that kind of same thing, you know, the kind of how the 80s rewrote the history culturally, you know, the 50s and 60s, particularly the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I thought about in this was our attitude towards people who do, you know, try to fight against this or that, people who are involved in protests or whatever, you know, has our attitudes looking at people who are protesters as lazy hippies or self-entitled college students, and, you know, they sure as hell deserve getting cracked open in the skull, has a lot of that, what we grew up with in the age, affected our viewpoint, and has that actually damaged resistance?
Okay, well, the answer is yes. The answer is that I do think that we have looked at political activism since the 80s because in part of the revision of the 60s activism. We have ended up looking at activism since the 80s as something not serious, something not not important. And I think that was certainly the case through up until a little bit of, like, it changed a little bit in the darkest years of the Iraq War. Not even the beginning of the Iraq War, sort of like both when people were protesting the Iraq War and everybody hated George Bush. In the beginning of the Iraq War, a lot of people liked George Bush. So it changed, like, I think things that 80s idea, protest is stupid, because that's the chaotic, stupid, silly, unserious 60s, the 80s version of the 60s. I think that paradigm lasted without any question until probably 2005. And I still think it lasted until then, through that. I think it was challenged a little bit, but here's and this is the conclusion of my book, is that, well, where are certain 80s paradigms ending? I actually think that the Tea Party folks have, because they have now adopted 60s protests, and literally, Saul Alinsky, right? I think they have inadvertently called into question at least some of the 80s framing of the tactics that we lambaste. And I think that that's actually, though I disagree vehemently with a lot of what the Tea Party stands for, I think that their validation of the ethos of 60s-style protest has helped potentially really enduringly change that 80s paradigm that denigrated 60s-style protest.
That was commentator David Sirota, interviewed by Aaron Sinek of Chicagoist. We're coming to you from the trenches. The recent nuclear calamity affecting the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan has forced many authorities and people worldwide to rethink their commitment to nuclear energy. The question is deeply pertinent to Illinois, which is home to 11 online power plants, the most of any state in the Union. What's more, 75% of electricity in Chicago comes from nuclear power plants. And the group Exelon, the world's largest owner of nuclear power plants, is headquartered in Chicago. What would happen if a nuclear calamity were to strike in the Chicago area? We'll learn more from Dr. Andrew Cantor from the group Physicians for Social Responsibility, who discussed the question in this encore presentation from 2006 on the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, which originally aired on Chicago's CAN TV cable network and on a previous episode of From the Trenches. Dr. Cantor.
I start with this quote because I think it's always important, and it's that the splitting of the atom changed everything save our modes of thinking, and thus we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. And what Albert Einstein was saying there was that in this world we live in now, this new nuclear world, that there are all sorts of threats, all sorts of paths that might lead us to destruction, and that unless we really change the way we think about things in light of those consequences of our actions, that really that was the direction that we're going to be heading in. So what I'm going to talk about today really is, you know, what are some of the things that we can do to possibly change the path that we're on? Now, Katrina, if I had given this talk, you know, a year ago, I wouldn't have been able to have a reference point like Hurricane Katrina, which really for all of us was a wake-up call. On several different fronts. And as you probably are aware, this was a catastrophe on a scale unparalleled within the United States in terms of the numbers of people who were affected, the property damage, and the also sort of the poor response of our government to actually protecting the population. Now, we've long known that accidents could happen, and we've often I've talked about in the past nuclear accidents in particular, but we've always had to rely on the fact that the government, quote unquote, would take care of us or would be able to respond to those kinds of accidents. What we've seen is that, and then in the reports that have come out of the Katrina and Rita experience, is that the government is not prepared. And so what I'm going to really talk to you today is about what this experience has taught us, specifically around the likelihood of a nuclear accident here in Chicago and what we might learn about it. First of all, right now there's about 104 operating nuclear power plants in the United States. There's about 36 non-power reactors that are in universities and use highly enriched uranium. Here in Illinois, we actually have the most reactors of any state in the union. We're the most nuclear state, with 11 actually all right here around northern Illinois, potentially affecting Chicago. We're going to be talking specifically about the Braidwood reactors here, but then there's also the Dresden and LaSalle reactors. Now, there's a lot of talk that nuclear power is going to be the solution to global warming. Now, what we know here is that right now nuclear power makes up about 8% of the nation's power grid. It is not a major source of electricity for the United States. And what I'm going to hopefully try to explain to you is that the risks of nuclear power is specifically around both the safety and the security and the storage of nuclear waste makes this not the right choice for our energy security. Little background, there are really two different types of nuclear power plants in the United States that affect us. On the left side here is the boiling water reactors, and if you'll notice here that the water is used for cooling the reactor here circulates around, powers the steam, powers the turbine, generates electricity. In the example of the pressurized water reactor, which is this is like the Dresden reactor, the pressurized water reactor, which is like the Braidwood reactor, has a different cycle where the actual radioactive water usually stays here within the core, and the cooling water is a separate link. But all we also know, the recent tritium links from the Braidwood reactors, is that nuclear power plants create all sorts of different kinds of radioactivity. It doesn't all just stay in this loop right here. The important thing, I think, really to note here is that how critical water is to nuclear power. And that's why nuclear power plants are pretty much situated either on rivers or near lakes, because they require a great deal of water to stay cool. In addition to the nuclear plant itself, the core of the reactor, which like the core that exploded and released radioactivity in Chernobyl, also contains a great deal of radioactivity that are stored in cooling ponds actually on the site around the nuclear reactors themselves. Now, these spent fuel storage areas are typically contain massive amounts of radioactivity because they take many copies, essentially, of the fuel that are in the reactors, and after about 1 to 2 years, they're actually put out into these cooling ponds for storage. Now, so as I mentioned here, that this is somewhere around 10 times amount of radiation that's actually within the core itself, which is somewhere in the order of 20 to 50 million curies of radioactivity. If you think about the Chernobyl accident, that released only 2 million curies. So we're talking about 10 times to 20, 30 times that amount of radioactivity that are in these storage pools. Now, if you notice, these pools, they're really, it's unlike the reactor core, which has this very thick cement dome over it to protect the reactor. These typically are just submerged underwater. And in the buildings that are somewhat, you know, along the construction of, let's say, a Kmart, they're a lightly constructed steel and girder type buildings, clearly not as secure from a terrorism attack or a plane crash, for example, as the core itself. And the type of covering in this case is not one that would protect at all from any release of radiation. As I mentioned before, that the core itself is protected by a containment dome. Now, this dome is several feet thick and is actually a pretty good protection against the outside world. Now, there hasn't been very many studies, and certainly not that has ever proven that the core itself would be protected from an accident along the lines of what happened at the World Trade Center, a jumbo jet flying into the nuclear plants. These plants are often situated very close to the airports or on flight paths, so this is not an unreasonable expectation. We also mentioned, as you noticed earlier, that the plants themselves are very dependent upon the coolant. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if you knew that during the heat waves that were in France just this last year, or actually 2003, that the water temperature in the rivers got so hot that they actually had to shut off the nuclear power plants because they couldn't. The water wasn't cool enough to keep the power plants cool down. So water is critical, and any disruption of that water is also a potential disaster for the core itself. Now, the spent fuel ponds that I just mentioned before, because we have no real permanent storage for nuclear waste, as we know now, that, or you may not know, that the Yucca Mountain proposal is still quite controversial and does not even cover all of the nuclear waste that we have right now. Most of this waste is being stored on site in these pools. Now, originally, the pools were designed to only hold, you know, these fuel for maybe, you know, a couple of years after the reactor had been emptied. They're now having to store fuel up 30, 40 years worth. So what they've done is packed them very tightly inside these coolant pools to try to maintain the storage facilities. But that also means that they're overcrowded and potentially vulnerable, again, to if any loss of that water for them to be exposed to fire and heat. Now, after 9/11, there was a lot of concern about security on nuclear power plants, and you would think that that would be a rational response. But what happened actually was that there was some minor increases in security that had occurred afterwards, and there really was no significant change in the plant security or those around the spent fuel ponds. So we're here talking about a power plant containing a great deal of radioactive material, both in the plant itself and in the storage ponds, and we're potentially vulnerable either for accident or for terrorism. So before I go in and actually tell you what the scenario is going to be about the accident, I need to give you a little bit of information about what radiation is. And I know that, you know, a lot of people already know a lot about radiation, so I'm not going to spend a great deal of time about it. But one thing that's very important to realize, and particularly this has come out fairly recently with some very strong publications, that is that there is no safe level of radiation. Okay, we're not sure if it's a linear dose response or not, but we do know that there is no threshold. There is no, quote-unquote, safe level of radiation. Every person has a certain risk if they are exposed to radiation. Each cell has a certain risk of becoming a malignant cell, developing cancer, et cetera. And that when we talk about populations of people being exposed to radiation, very small doses can have effects in populations because they're multiplied by multiple people. So when we start at the very low end of the spectrum, even low doses can have genetic consequences. We know that. We can slightly higher doses affect the bone marrow in our bodies, the rapidly turning over cells, the white blood cells that help us fight infection, the blood cells that help us carry oxygen, our hair cells, the cells that line our gut. These are our cells in our body that are rapidly growing and changing, and therefore they're highly susceptible to basically having damage to that sort of process of dividing from radiation. The higher and higher the doses of radiation you get, the more and more damage to these cells, ultimately leading to the point that you either die from loss of fluids and disruption of all of the organ systems of your body, or due to loss of all of those white blood cell counts, just as like patients who've gone through chemotherapy, they're exposed to infectious disease and they can die very easily. So we talk about, you know, biological and genetic effects on one end, all the way up to almost certain death for doses above about 600 rem. Now, radiation sickness, I'm going to talk a little bit about radiation sickness when we talk about numbers. The thing about radiation sickness is it's not very pleasant. Okay, so, I mean, it's certainly not something anyone wants to experience. The thing about it is also that there's no way to know whether the radiation sickness is due to a dose that only produced the sort of the nausea, the vomiting, the diarrhea, and I could survive given the right amount of supportive care from someone who's actually had over 600 rem, let's say, and that's they're going to have the same kind of radiation sickness, but they're going to die, which means there's no way to sort of triage or think about this. Many people who are going to feel sick are going to think they've had a lethal dose or a very strong dose of radiation, and that means that the amount of the population that are going to be seeking help in the case of any sort of radioactive exposure is going to be very high, and that will I'll talk specifically about that in a moment. So let me talk a little bit about the specifics. This is a proposal or scenario that the Physicians for Social Responsibility, also the Union of Concerned Scientists, have run with various nuclear power plants around the country under different kinds of scenarios. So what we're talking about here is Braidwood. It's about 50 miles or so southwest of Chicago. It's a pressurized water reactor, as I showed you before, which has some implications in terms of the possible breach of the containment vessel, the need for high pressures for the coolant supply and so on. But it's more important to say that we're anticipating two different kind of scenarios here at Braidwood. One will be a reactor vessel breach. And what we're anticipating here is either through an accident a la Chernobyl or a deliberate attempt at disrupting the coolant leads to a complete meltdown of the plant, breach of the containment vessel, release of a large plume of radioactivity. The second scenario is a spent fuel pond fire. As I mentioned before, the possibility of a small plane, for example, could easily penetrate these ponds. The disruption of that coolant, which is actually more important, but at a much more vulnerable level, could expose the nuclear power reactor assemblies. They overheat, they actually catch fire, and they burn for several days, releasing the radioactive material. Now, the way we do this is we actually use two different tools. And these are the same tools that the government uses. So, either believe us or don't, but at least both of us are using the same tools. The first is this program called HPAC, which is the Hazard Prediction Assessment Capability. And this is used by the Defense Threat Reduction Agency to actually model what the kind of nuclear, biological, or chemical contamination or releases would be for various kinds of scenarios. We combine that data with something that's called CATS, which is the consequence assessment tool set from FEMA. And this helps us plan, if it doesn't help them plan, but it helps us plan what are the effects on the actual infrastructure in our society, things like doctors, hospitals, police, fire, and so on. So let's get into the scenario. Catastrophic coolant failure, breach of the containment dome, loss of the core with a meltdown, 4% an hour means that over about a period of a day, the entire core would have been vaporized and lead to a plume or a cloud, which would then, depending on the wind, would travel, assuming it's a summer day, somewhat quite warmer than today, with normal temperatures and broken clouds.
You're listening to Dr. Andrew Cantor from the Physicians for Social Responsibility. At this point in the presentation, Dr. Cantor showed a map of the Chicago region with a red circle around the Braidwood nuclear power plant and a yellow highlighted plume area covering about two-thirds of the length north and south of Chicago as far east as South Bend, Indiana, and parts of Michigan. Dr. Cantor.
And the different colors represent the different exposure levels over a period of about 72 hours for that plume to move. Now, the different colors also tell us what the likely exposure levels are. Now, the scenario that we used uses census data from 1990, which means it's probably, we know it's out of date, so these numbers are quite a bit lower than it would probably be in real life. But what we see right here is that at least about 1,750 people were going to receive what we call the LD50 dose, which is probably a lethal dose, 50% chance of actually dying from the lethal dose. Those are people that are situated very close to the reactor itself. We have about 20,000 people where they would receive significant doses of radiation, probably in the 200 rem area, where they're likely to get very sick. and likely to die. Another 200,000 people would actually be suffering from those cases of acute radiation sickness that I described earlier, quite uncomfortable with hair falling out and vomiting and nausea and diarrhea. And then on top of that, you've got this area here, which is, it's a little hard to see. I'll show you in the next slide a little bit easier. But this larger area here are those people that would exceed, would basically exposed to enough radiation to exceed their entire annual occupational dose. There's a different level of dose that the government says is safe for me to experience during my year of working in a nuclear power plant. Now, what we're saying here is that 4.5 million people would be exposed in that day and a half or 2 days to the amount of radiation that a radiation worker would be allowed to expose in an entire year. So that's those, again, it's a significant amount of radiation, low on the grand scheme of things. But when you're talking about, you know, 4.5 million, 5 million people, that's a significant amount. Now, here's another map, and this is looking at it a little bit differently. So the map I showed you was the radiation exposure from breathing in the dose of radiation or the radiation that occurs from the plume itself. But we can also look at what sort of the acute reaction is or the acute dose of the radiation. And here, it's a slightly different kind of view of this. We still see that there's about 200,000 people, 200,000 people with acute radiation sickness. I mean, we can't even deal with, you know, a bus or a train crash that may send 100 people to a hospital. We're talking 200,000 people with acute radiation sickness. We're talking here about 4.5 million people with a dose of 5 rem. Now, 5 rem is about the equivalent of, oh, I'd say 50 or so chest x-rays at one time. Okay, so it's not a meaningless amount of radiation. It's a fairly significant amount. And the area here you see in sort of dark brown, kind of orange color, is actually the area for which the Environmental Protection Agency has set as the either shelter or evacuation zone requirements. So these are this is the dose level. See, it's much less than the 5 rem, and it's going to be the kind of dose where they're going to say, look, in that area, we make sure that everyone has to get out. So we're talking about 6.5 million people would have to be evacuated.
Where?
And the question is where and when, you know, how to make sure that they don't go this way. You know, you want them to go that way if they're going to go. So this is the kind of thing that we're going to talk a little bit about preparedness. What you see here is that this is like Katrina on terms of scale, in terms of evacuation requirement and the people affected, but we're talking not about several thousand people being killed. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. And it's a significant risk to our society. Now, what does this really mean? First of all, as I said before, our system is not prepared for anything like this at all. The numbers of people who are acutely ill, who those people who are going to die, and those people who need supportive help are going to overwhelm any kind of medical care facilities that we have in this area. Not to mention, if you look at this, that there's 113 hospitals that are actually in the plume. So not only do we have the people that we have to have them treated somewhere, but what about all the people in the hospital? Yeah. They have to be moved somewhere else and be treated by somewhere else, some other people. So we're talking about 32,000 beds basically being taken away from our capacity in the hospitals by the accident itself. Now, as a physician, you know, I may be all altruistic, and I might want to put myself at risk, you know, to help people. But here we're talking about 20,000 doctors being in that plume and actually receiving a dose that would basically take them out of being able to care for people. So like the liquidators in Chernobyl that have certain amounts of dose, they can only go in for a certain amount of time, you got 20,000 doctors who aren't going to be able to treat anybody because they've already experienced the massive dose of radiation themselves. They're going to. It's like, you know, working in the x-ray machine, they have to stay away now. So this is, puts a huge burden on our ability to actually deal with this. Now, we think about physicians in hospitals, they're concentrated, you know, in urban areas and likely would be affected by this. But on the other side of it, think about the police and the fire. I mean, they're the people, like in Hurricane Katrina, that we really are going to depend upon to help us here. Now, the people who are exposed right around Braidwood, like the 25 people who work at the fire station in Essex County, they are going to receive lethal doses or potentially lethal doses of radiation. Okay, they're not going to be in any position to be helping people. The 67 firefighters who are in Braidwood and Hersher fire departments are also going to be likely to be sick. So, you know, again, they're going to have to bring in people from the outside to take care of this, because the people who are actually in those communities themselves are not going to be available. Like the 10,500 firefighters in 355 other departments are all basically going to have their, you know, their radiation badges or whatever exceeded. They're basically not going to be able to stay. They're going to have to be evacuated with everybody else, which means who's going to be there in the society to take care of the people who are still there. So this is a pretty dramatic and drastic situation. And we have 11 of these reactors around Chicago and certainly within the plume characterization that I just described you. And if you notice from that earlier map, that the plume extended quite a bit farther. Matter of fact, it extended over the lake, which means that if these reactors were even farther away from us, Chicago would still be affected by the plumes. Not to mention, you got to imagine all that radiation being dumped in the lake, which is our water supply. And so this doesn't even take anything into account, all the radiation that might possibly be incorporated through the water supply. Now, a nuclear plant accident is fairly rare. I mean, Chernobyl was clearly the worst disaster that in the history of mankind, but there are, you know, the possibility of terrorism, as I mentioned before, and so on. Where the other scenario I'm going to talk to you about now is something that is potentially much smaller, but also is much more likely, because all that additional radiation that I mentioned earlier stored in these spent fuel ponds actually around the reactors themselves. Zion, right up north of us on the lake, as well as the 11 reactors, all carry these spent fuel ponds. Now, unfortunately, our software is somewhat limited here, and we can only model 3 assemblies being destroyed. Now, these assemblies, you know, may be so big. Typically, a fire, like an airplane flying into one of these things, loss of coolant, would, you know, 10 times this number of assemblies would be likely destroyed and burned. But just this kind of gives you an idea of what we're talking about. The assemblies themselves contain cesium-137. And I didn't really go into much about the specific different radionuclides that would come from the plant. You're probably aware of like iodine, and when an active nuclear power plant ruptures like Chernobyl, what you would do is you have a great deal of release of radioactive iodine in the air, which concentrates in the thyroid glands of particularly kids and pregnant women who are susceptible to radiation. But cesium-137 is not as easily transmitted. It's not like a gas like the iodine, but it stays highly radioactive and is like potassium and concentrates in muscles and produces cancer and so on. So same situation, summer day, normal temperatures, broken clouds. Well, you know, before I go into this, it's like, well, what's the likelihood? Aren't we going to protect ourselves from terrorism or an accident in the spent fuel ponds? Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission actually was sort of broached with this problem and said, look, you know, this is a terrorism risk. It's very easily accessible. You know, we've got a Walmart-like building on top of a roof on top of these things. What's to protect us? And their response was, well, we don't need to worry about it because, you know, the possibility of a terrorist attack against these spent fuel ponds is, quote unquote, speculative and simply too far removed from the natural or expected consequences of their agency action. And therefore, there really has been no change at all to security for these spent fuel ponds. So, you know, I'm sure that the World Trade Center was not something that was natural or expected for that particular situation. So this is a real risk. And one of the things I think, as we talk about ways that we can prepare ourselves or minimize the risks, we can deal with it. Now, as you can see, the plume is a much smaller exposure. We still have hundreds to thousands of people being exposed as well as sick. The amount of radiation is much lower, but can continue to meet all the way up to Chicago. We still have, you know, in tens of thousands people would have to be evacuated from the spent fuel pond fires. And I can imagine that, you know, typically, as I mentioned earlier, this would be on the orders of 30 times the size or 10 to 30 times the size of the one I just modeled. Now, I've talked to you a little bit about Braidwood. I've talked to you about these spent fuel ponds. We have other examples. The Union of Concerned Scientists did a study. The Indian Point nuclear reactor, which is just north of Manhattan, They did a study that said, well, if the same situation had happened there in that reactor like the ones here near Chicago, they would anticipate there could be somewhere between 3,500 to 44,000 immediate deaths due to the radiation, and that the likely exposure to that population would lead to 100 to 500,000 long-term additional deaths from cancer. So this is a substantial amount of morbidity and mortality associated with this. This is an example for New York. I mean, we're in Chicago. We may not care about New York, but it is something that we do need to think about ourselves. The economic damage, like, you know, Chernobyl, there was huge areas that were no longer habitable that had to be evacuated. If that should happen here in Chicago or like here in New York City, the likely economic consequences are extravagant, ranging in the $1 to $2 trillion range for not only the cleanup but also the damage to the economy. So I've kind of painted a kind of an ugly picture. You know, these nuclear power plants, we've got 104 of them around the country. Some of them, 11 of them are very close to us here in Chicago. Well, are we prepared? Well, the answer to that question is no. Now, we've gotten several different reports about this, certainly after Katrina, where there was a real assessment of the nation's preparedness. We know that up to this point, we've done really poor job of doing that. The American Disaster Preparedness Foundation did a study of the major metropolitan areas around the country, and unfortunately, the Midwest scored the lowest. We actually had the most inadequate preparation in the Midwest, although Chicago, I'll say the city of Chicago, actually did fairly well. It got a C+. And that was because they actually had some pretty good training around the potential for a disaster, but not specifically around a nuclear reactor accident or with the appropriate equipment. So they only got a C+. Now, typically, Physicians for Social Responsibility comes in and they tell you, well, I mean, we can't survive this. I mean, you know, it's 8 million people having to be evacuated, hundreds of thousands of people being radiation sick, you know, like the Indian Point, hundreds of thousands of people dying. There's no way we can adequately prepare for this. The only treatment for this kind of a disease is really prevention. So I want to start by saying we need to prevent this, and I'll touch on this at the end, but we also need to have common sense. And the common sense says, well, in the unlikely situation that this does happen or one of the lower probability situations, we should be prepared. So what do we need to do to be prepared? Well, we've learned a lot from Katrina, and we've learned a lot from Chernobyl, and that is that we need central coordination. We do depend upon the federal government to help us here. Now, Chicago, actually the plants around Chicago, are ringed by biological or radioactive monitoring devices. Now, this is actually critical because one of the first things we need to know is, A, has an accident actually occurred? And, you know, the Chernobyl accident, no one was told about it for 2 days. We know that the tritiated water leak that occurred down in the Braidwood, we didn't hear about it for 10 years. So we really want to make sure that, A, we have to find out if this is going to happen immediately. And because the majority of the injuries from a reactor accident as opposed to like a nuclear bomb is due to the radiation, we have to protect people from that radioactive cloud, which means they either have to get out of the way or they have to shelter. They actually have to make sure that they don't go outside. You can imagine what would happen if it looked like Katrina with everyone lined up on the highways just waiting and then having that cloud go right over the top of everybody. I mean, that would be like the worst case scenario. So that means that not only do we need to know that there's been an accident, we need to know where it is, which way the wind's blowing, and somebody has to be there to say, well, do you evacuate? Do you shelter? Okay. This means that we need to educate people about what they're going to have to do. They need to understand what the risks are if they're going to live downwind of a nuclear power plant so that they can actually do the right thing if something should happen. So education, the use of potassium iodine, we talked about this in a previous NEIS discussion, but the ability to block the radioactive iodine from, you know, concentrating in the thyroid glands means you have to know actually before the accident happens, to take it. Well, but the idea being is it needs to be taken as soon as possible after the accident, which means, again, it needs to be available. People need to be educated about their use of it. And more importantly, the societies, the communities, need to understand what the plan is. Now, the one thing that Chicago got docked highly in this analysis in the national safety or preparedness study was that nobody knows what the evacuation plans are. They mean they may be there, but none of the local community responders know about it, and certainly the people don't understand what it is, and therefore we can't expect that they're really going to do the right thing. So monitoring and more transparency about what the real risks of this are so that we can be prepared.
That was Dr. Andrew Cantor from the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Rita San, Aaron Sinek, Mitchell Schpeinchik, and to the staff of Chicago Scan TV for audio assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode from the Trenches.